The Morning Show with Greg Berg is next.
Support for The Morning Show comes from Carthage College, where students can conduct NASA research, produce an original play, or join an in-house marketing agency as early as their freshman year. More information available at carthage.edu. And we welcome you to the Tuesday Morning Show on WGTD. I'm Gregory Berg. I'm very pleased for the next few minutes to be speaking with an extremely talented writer by the name of Laureen Carey and talking about her most recent book, which is a truly beautiful memoir called Lady Sitting, My Year with Nana at the End of Her Century. This is the story of Laureen Carey and her husband taking in her grandmother, known as Nana, at the very end of her life. And she was literally 100 years old, even 101 years old, during this time that she was living with Laureen Carey. And it was a powerful experience, also not often an easy experience, transformative in more ways than one. And Laureen Carey has the gifts to tell this story very vividly and poignantly. She has a number of works to her credit, including three previous novels, as well as a play, My General Tubman, and a one-act opera, which is, I believe, based on this memoir. She teaches at the University of Pennsylvania. And her book, again, is titled Lady Sitting, My Year with Nana at the End of Her Century, published by W.W. Norton. Laureen Carey, we welcome you to The Morning Show.
Wow, thank you so very much. I'm glad to be with you. That's a great introduction. I have nothing else to say.
Well, and I didn't even touch on the fact that although this book is primarily about your relationship with your grandmother, Nana, and the experience of taking her into your home at the end of her life, but your book certainly touches on many other facets of your family's complicated life stretching back several generations. I'm wondering, as you began work on this book, did you have the intention from the start that it would be, in a sense, as sprawling a story as it is? I mean, that you would tell all of these other stories beyond your relationship with your grandmother? Or did that sort of spring into being along the way as you began to write this story?
Well, you know, I'll tell you, the story started with a very, very specific memory. But I've written novels. I've also written one other memoir, which was about going to boarding school in New England, sort of at the beginning of coeducation, beginning of integration. So I know in the back of my mind that a memoir starts specifically, but it pulls in everything. And similarly, that hospice time with an elderly loved one pulls in all of her life and, you know, her life and the people who were her immediate relatives or father or grandparents. But it also pulls in our everything we touch, our whole society. So I do know that all roads, you know, lead back to Nana's little plate with three sweets on it, right, for every night, and that that little plate leads out to the world. So there's no way you can tell Nana's story without also reaching to her father, who left North Carolina soon after, you know, the Jim Crow era shut down all the work he was trying to do during Reconstruction. That's part of her story. And that comes into my life in the same way that our time together, you know, listening to Eugene Ormandy conduct at the Academy of Music comes into our life.
One thing you write towards the beginning of the book is that after she died, meaning after your Nana died, I felt stuck for years. I couldn't sweep up the odd bits of her business. Tell us more about what you mean by those words, and then in what ways the writing of this book was a means to sweep up the odd bits of her business.
Hmm. Yeah, I meant that literally, metaphorically, spiritually, emotionally. She did have a business. My grandmother was a trustee of a real estate, a very small real estate holding in Philadelphia. The point of that holding had been started by G. Edward and Addie Dickerson, who were African-American pioneers here in Philadelphia. They bought houses, and the idea was that those houses would be rented, have lots of rental properties, and the money from that rent would go to, I think their will says, to improve the Negro race. Their business partner was my grandmother's father, and so he passed the business on to her as a trustee. In other words, she collected the rent. She took between 6 and 10%. And then when the mortgages were paid off sometime after, as she said, sometime after the war in the 50s, she began to give out small scholarships to African-American students going to college. The business, though, included those apartments. She sold most of them in the year when she was living with us. It was her house that she refused to sell because she always said, well, honey, if you and Bob put me out, where will I go? Nana, we're not going to put you out. But she would not sell her house. So the house had to be sold, and this was right, she died in 2008, you know, right when you could no longer sell anything, any house, anywhere. As well as family business that was left undone. It had to do with her relationship with my dad. It was all those bits and pieces, and I couldn't move.
Explain the circumstances under which your grandmother had to come to live with you and your husband. I mean, explain kind of the storm of various health issues that finally became so serious that she simply could not continue to live alone at that advanced age of, I think, 99, if I remember correctly.
Right. You know, Nana figured out workarounds. And one of the things I really worked to do in this book is to do as lyrical a telling as I could about this. Everything that happened, she just figured out another way to go. She lived in a two-story house. And when she took some arthritis medicine that was supposed to help with her pain. She didn't have a lot of pain, but she took this medicine, and she had one day where she said, oh, honey, this is amazing. And then the next day, she could no longer walk very far unaided. It did something in her very elderly system. So then I had a wheelchair in the back of my car for going long distances. We put that at the bottom of her steps. We got another light, small wheelchair for upstairs. She would transfer, and Nana would go up the steps backwards on her bottom, same way you teach a two-year-old to come down. She had something that she called tennis elbow. The doctor said it was a stroke that affected her hand and arm, and she rubbed it and she moved it. She, just before that, had continued to drive to work until she was 94. She had a car accident where she said she was stomping on the brake and the car kept going faster. She would never, ever hear that maybe she had touched the gas, not the brake. But it went straight across the street. It's called Broad Street in Philadelphia. It used to be the High Street. It's the big cross street. It was a miracle that she sped through that intersection without hitting anybody. Hit one of the bollocks that are put in front of the gas station to keep cars from accidentally hitting the gas tank. And her head went into the car window. My daughter, who walked from high school past there, said to me later, she said, Mommy, we were coming out from school. I thought that was Nana. It looked like Nana's car, but I said it couldn't be. And there was a hole in the windshield right where her head was. I mean, she somehow lived through that. Finally, it was one final. She had shingles. She had had pneumonia. She'd gotten better from all of them. She finally had one last urinary tract infection that her immune system couldn't clear. And when she went to the hospital for that, her doctor told me, he said, "Well, I don't know. You know, she might make it. She might not." Sent her to the hospital. The social workers there said, who does she live with? Where does she live? And the idea that she would go back to a two-story neo-colonial house in suburban New Jersey by herself was unsustainable.
Hmm. I wonder if you would mind telling our listeners the story of one of the other sort of workarounds that that your grandmother created for herself when it became essentially impossible for her to make it anymore to her bathroom. Tell our listeners about the bucket beside her bed and the outrage that you caused your grandmother at some point when you insisted that that bucket be replaced.
Well, I tried to insist. There was no insisting. She said that was a waste of money. It was a total waste of money. She had a bucket next to the bed. It was a plastic mop bucket, and she would use that. Remember, Nana grew up in North Carolina. She was born in 1907. We had to change that, by the way. Her Social Security is at 1909. She had been shaving 2 years off her age for years. Finally, she said, "Oh, go ahead and fix it. It doesn't matter anymore." 1907, North Carolina, they had used outhouses. They had used chamber pots. So when it became difficult to get around her bed, across the hall, into the bed, she just put that bucket there and used it. And on top of it, to cover, she used the cardboard that's left. It's at the bottom of a legal pad. So she had that cardboard on top. The fact is, after a while, plastic fatigues, and it can no longer be bleached back to really to cleanliness. So it her sense of smell had gone somewhat. And I said, "Oh, Nana, you can't upstairs. You can't have a we can't do this, Nana. We can't have a pissy. You can't do this. She thought, oh, honey, you're just too tough. Don't worry about it. No. So one day, I did what I started to do, which is we had these quiet control battles. I brought a bucket. I put it upstairs. I took her bucket out into my car, took it home, got rid of it. And she was furious that I had had the temerity to do that. And, you know, all the ways that we know ourselves as adults, right? We drive, we make money, we take care of ourselves, we cook our own food. And finally, we toilet ourselves. That's, she worked so hard to keep all of those under her control. And the fact that I would snatch it was very insulting to her.
Hmm.
Very insulting.
For those of you just joining us, I'm speaking with Lorraine Carey. We're talking about her most recent book, which is called Lady Sitting, My Year with Nana at the End of Her Century. This is the story of how Lorraine Carey and her husband took in her grandmother, Nana, when she was 99 years old. And she lived past the century mark. And this is a story not only about that experience of bringing her into their home, but also a look back at Nana's whole life, and for that matter, other branches of a somewhat complicated family tree. You tell us at one point that that your Nana liked to talk about her own racial heritage as a League of Nations, which to your young ears sounded like Liga Nations. It was, in your words, a way for her to sidestep the given typical categories. Just tell us a little bit about this League of Nations heritage of Nana and the way in which that was a good way to describe her heritage and maybe also a way in which it helped her make sense of it.
Sure. You know, America did this with the one-drop rule, right? One drop of black blood and you were black. Well, it made sense in slavery because then everybody who inherited African heritage could be bought and sold. So, you know, it was, as they say in hip-hop, more money, more money. It also created a whole colorism is what we call it. But, you know, people who worked in the house, people outside, all that, and who got what privilege, who was able to do what. And Nana's people came from, they came from free people of color. Her father's father, Napoleon, was a man who was the, we understood that he had both black and white heritage and was free. She said that there was a Jewish woman who had been sent to live with them because she was having an out-of-wedlock child, and somehow that lady got into the family tree. I never quite understood that. There were all these free people who were either light-skinned or, in fact, could pass for white, who either, some of them, she had a sister who moved away and chose to pass for white, or who made their lives in the community, in the black community, in various ways. But Nana, just as now, young people are trying to complicate and break up America's commercial, sort of the commercial definition of black, which is, if you're black, I can sell you. You know, if you're black, you're a nickel in my pocket, which is how they said in the 19th century. The caste, as Isabel Wilkerson has said it, young people now are complicating it by saying black and brown, people of color. They're doing all kinds of things to complicate this. And for years, African Americans called themselves, called ourselves so many names. Afric-American, that was first, I mean, I saw that in a reference in some place in 1819. Afro-Americans, Black Americans, Colored Americans, everything they could to dodge America's I'll define you bullet, because the I'll define you was always a definition that was inferior. So everybody's trying to say, well, no, I'm not this. I'm that. You think I'm this, I'm actually that. You think I'm inferior, I'm actually this. I'm actually something else. And Nana used that sort of old beginning of the 19th century term, League of Nations. Except every now and then Nana's voice was sort of North Carolina. She put it down on the throat like that. So she called it a League of Nations, which always sounded like it rhymed with the N-word to me. So when I was a kid, that sounded like League of Nations, sounded like you know what a nation. I also knew that it pissed my mother off for her to say that, League of Nations, because it seemed a way of not claiming to be white, but of stepping away from blackness.
Interesting.
So it was a very complicated solution for her.
You tell us that at least for long stretches of time, you spent a fair amount of time with your grandmother, with your Nana, and that was probably at least partly because you lived in a home in which there was a fair amount of tension. You write at one point, as early as I can remember, a leitmotif of tension played through our apartment. Often anger, sometimes rage. I loved them so much, meaning your parents, and I was afraid of them individually and together. I suspect that because it was a tense, difficult relationship, that's part of why you ended up feeling so close to your Nana. Tell us more about what your relationship was with her earlier in your life.
Oh, totally. You know, could I just read a little bit, not very much?
Sure.
A little bit about that, because sometimes I start to talk it and I think, oh, I really wrote it better than I can say. why was it that weekends at Nana Jackson felt like a world apart? Maybe because, dressed in old ball gowns, I traveled with the sun patch across the floor of the suburban New Jersey neo-colonial and soaked in more light and luxe than my parents' West Philadelphia apartment could ever offer. Delight and time, the wide-armed, fragrant mimosa to climb in summer, the fireplace to soak in winter, and choices all the day long, whatever your little heart desires. Yes, 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 I knew that I was being spoiled. That word that obsessed black grown-ups and even kids. What could be worse than to be spoiled, ruined by indulging, incapable of withstanding hardship, as we had done and would do in future? We were brought up by hand, as surely as Pip, in Great Expectation, and much prouder of it than he. It was delicious. Nana loved it. She had one son. She loved the little girlness. She loved to sew and make dolls and cook. A little girl was an apt mentee for all of the domestic arts. She loved to doll me up. She loved to make clothes for me and fit them. She would go to Canada in the summer and buy plaids and then come back and make skirts with pleats, and she would show me how you make the pleat and the seam so that the plaid matched perfectly, and how you sew it and the steam would come up. And she'd say, come here, let me try this on. She loved to shop, and I would go along with her. My pop-up also wonderfully, this was her second husband, wonderfully spoiling, delighted. They just had a ball having a little girl around. Mm-hmm. Pop had had a daughter who had committed suicide when she was in her 20s. I later discovered there was a gorgeous picture of her looking very much like Rita Moreno as Tup Tim in The King and I. Mm. That picture was in black and white and shiny, and when I learned to read cursive, I realized that the name on the picture was the same name he called me. She said, you know, to Dad from your little rascal, which was what Pop had always called me.
Mm. Yeah. You wrote at one point, I visited Nana 3, 4, 5, 6 times a week. The visits were as necessary as food and water. One of my favorite stories in the book is of where your Nana kept her cash in the sock drawer, and of how and of what sometimes she would ask you to do in terms of helping her with her money. Tell our listeners how your help would be enlisted and just how much money we're talking about here.
Oh, dear Lord, yes. I must say, by the way, that sometimes I collage very quickly in the book the childhood and the adulthood. In childhood, I went to her house on weekends. She'd pick me up Friday. I'd go home Sunday night. The 3, 4, 5, sometimes 6 times a week, really happened later in her life when she began to have illnesses in her 90s. So that was when I would go more and more often. That was, leading my family, running over, checking on her, get her supper, come back home. That was the 3, 4, 5. And it involved money. She had a couple of shoeboxes that were in her closet, but the money from her business and then her own money were kept on two separate sides of the dresser, the stand-up dresser of my grandfather's, my step-grandfather's, Pop-Pop's, after he died. Altogether, there was something like $40,000 in the house. It was so appalling that I had no idea. No idea. Until she was worried. She'd misplaced it, something. She'd moved something, you know, tried to make sure everything was safe. She'd moved something when a young woman, we were so glad that the guy who worked with her and was her handyman at the office suggested his cousin could do some cleaning for her. I said, thanks be to God, that's great. Phew, I could not do that. But after this young woman had been with her for a couple of months, Nana misplaced one of her packets of money that were in socks and shoeboxes. And she swore this girl had stolen from her and wouldn't have her in the house. I was terrified because you've heard how vulnerable Nana was living by herself. She made herself more vulnerable by having this money, which means that she didn't trust anybody to come in, which means that really the only people she trusted to come in were my sister and me, because especially during this 7-year silence, not speaking time, that she had with my dad. So she didn't trust anybody else. And, you know, my sister came down just as much as he could. But she was a young mother with a 1-year-old and a 3-year-old and living in Montclair, New Jersey. So it was really hard. What I started doing was putting it into the bank, and every week I would say to her, now, Let's not make you vulnerable. You don't need all this money in the house. Well, I need cash. What happens if it... She grew up during the Depression. She grew up, she remembered the leaving of North Carolina. She remembered her father losing all his money in the Depression. What happens if I need cash? I need cash. So, okay, now, do you need $40,000? Well, if you put it like that, I guess. Well, how about if I put $2,000 in the bank this week? And that'll leave you $38,000. It was like that. We did that every week until we got it down to, I don't know, something like $2,000 in the house.
You just made passing reference to something that is an important facet of Nana's story, that there was this period of estrangement between her and her son, your father. And this is one of a couple of different points when you talk about having to try to reconcile drastically different facets of who your grandmother was. At one point, you write, "This person who provided kindness and delight to my sister and me was at the same time the woman of whom my father, her only child, once said, 'She never loved me.'" And another place in the book where you talk about that is actually in reference to her business and the way in which she would deal with certain clients. And to your young eyes, you said, I didn't know how to hold in my mind the two Nanas, she who was so tender with me and she who was so cold to the people who lived down to the estate. Tell us more about the way in which your grandmother had these drastically different sides to her. It's probably something that is true about a fair number of people, but it sounds like it was especially true with your Nana.
Well, it was true of her, and because she was so luxuriously tender with me. This other side, I mean, we still quote this in the family every now and then, and we'll just all fall out laughing and say, "Honey, this is business. This is business." And when you say, "Honey, this is business," it means all bets are off. Everything that you said in the everything you said in the Nicene Creed, everything that you said when you say, "Now I lay me," this is different. There are new rules. It's not one set of rules. Nana, part of the animating question of this book, part of the reason I had to write it as an opera, actually, was trying to figure this out. What happened? Why is this true? What is it that I don't want to be true about this in my own life? And if that's true, how can I find it and change it in me? How can I forgive her for what felt to me like creating puddles of anger and consequences from those relationships that all of us had to walk through? Well, what can I do about that? What I learned, of course, in being with her, was that at the very bottom of what Nana knew, her own childhood trauma, her mother's dying when she was six, her father's growing up, the depression, the losing of the mother. What I learned was that at the bottom, Nana's idea was that it's every person for himself, finally. And that that there was no intimacy. There was no intimate relation that would trump that. That would change that. We know people in the military who say, "I will get in front of you, and I will guard you. I will give myself up." We know that that's one of the things that that binds people in law enforcement. We know that that's what binds people in families. That I'll do this. I'll give this up for you. Generations who say, "Yes, I'll work in this truck making these cheesesteaks for the rest of my life, so that my kid can become a physicist." Right? But there was no such switch in Nana. She would be loving up until she was endangered. You know, her mother had died. There was nobody there. I learned this. I remember tucking her in one night, and her neck was cold. Her neck was cold because she insisted on a fan that had to be exactly at her face, so she got exactly the right amount. It was a 40-minute deal going to sleep. Because her neck was cold, I brought down this tiny little, cheap little fleecy thing that my daughters always called the mommy blanket, and I would tuck them in with it when they were sick. It was a funny little bit of family magical thinking that when they were sick, they would say, "Oh, but can I have the mommy blanket too?" "Yes, yes." So I put the mommy blanket around Nana and told her what the kids had always said about it, tucked her in with it. And she said to me, "You know, I never had a mother to tuck me in like this." She had no memory of that wonderful feeling of being tucked in, having somebody pull the covers up to your neck. That's where it came from.
Mm. Wow. We're speaking with Lorene Carey. We're talking about her most recent book, which is called Lady Sitting, My Year with Nana at the End of Her Century. We should return to what, in a sense, is the heart of the story, which is the decision of you and your husband to take in Nana towards the very end of her life when she was 99 years old. By the way, tell our listeners about that intriguing first word of your book's title, Lady Sitting.
Lady Sitting was the word we used when Nana was furious that she didn't disagree with us, but she was furious with her incapacity to be alone. This woman who had been so independent, taken care of, you know, run her own business, stayed in her house, raised her son alone after her husband left when my dad was 13. The idea that she had to have somebody come and babysit her was infuriating. So we came up with, I said, "Nana, it's not babysitting, it's lady sitting. It's just keeping you company. You know, you're in the rectory by yourself. It's a different house. It's nice to have company, right?" So we used this word, lady sitting. Our older daughter, who had graduated college and was working her first job, and still at that point still lived in Philadelphia, would come over. She gave us Thursday night, every Thursday, like clockwork. She would come in, serve Nana dinner, and stay with her till evening. It gave all of us a chance. We would, you know, peel out of the driveway, whether it was just to go to a fast food or to drop us off at different places. My younger daughter might, you know, do a project with a friend at their house. My husband and I, sometimes, you know, we just go to a box store and look at hardware, or just anything. There are 60 million people doing this in America every year, taking care of a family member who is elderly or disabled in some way. They never get time off. Many of them have no money. They have no extra room. They don't have a hospital bed. Like, they don't have any help. When a family that we did have much more help than many people do. But when a family member comes over, a person whom that disabled person trusts, and you really can leave and not worry. I mean, Nana didn't, there were two nurses, finally, whom she liked during the day. But that was it. I mean, if it wasn't one of them or Laura, one night we had a couple who are friends of ours who came over and talked to her and admired her and listened to her stories, and she could be charming. She was elegant. She was charming. She had to wear earphones. It took me a long time to figure out how could she hear us better. So I got these earphones and went to Radio Shack, which was still open at the time, and got a microphone and plugged them in. So you would talk into the microphone, and it would concentrate the voice right into the earphones, which was great because then we could stop shouting at her, which made her feel, you know, infantile. So she wore the headphones. We went to a low vision specialist clinic here in Philadelphia and got her eyeglasses that were really very good at low vision for people who couldn't see far away. And so we had these different glasses. We got her super intense lights for when the sun went down. We did all of these so she could see and hear and feel more like herself. So that was where lady sitting came from.
I love that. One of the things that helped you kind of make sense of this in your head was that you would talk always about in the rectory. You say that those words symbolize the boundaries I tried to draw on the arrangement we were entering into. Briefly, what was behind those words about always referring to this as in the rectory, in the rectory?
In the rectory was a code word for this is a building that we are sharing. It's not our building. We're only here because Bob's the priest in the church next door. They, you know, we're in here, as my younger daughter would always say, she'd say, because it's a family business. That's why we have to live next to the shop. But we lived there, and she could stay here. It was a large, gracious house. Unlike the house I'm in right now is a tiny little Philadelphia three-story row house up and down. I don't know what we would have done had we needed. Well, we would have done fine. But she could have her own large parlor. She could understand it not as us doing charity, but that all of us were sharing this residence given to us by the church. And she was now part of that. She had been a cradle Episcopalian. She loved having a priest in the family. She always referred to Bob as, oh, it's so nice to have a priest in the family. She loved that we could go over when a wonderful organist was practicing and listen to him. So that was a way, like the word lady sitting, of continuing to give her dignity as opposed to saying, you know, you have to live with Bob and Lorraine.
I appreciate at one point in the book how you quote something that apparently is from your religious tradition, which is Cranmer's Prayer of Thanksgiving, and I think this is at least a portion of it. And we most humbly beseech thee, O Heavenly Father, so to assist us with thy grace that we may do all such good works as thou hast prepared for us to walk in. And this, of course, became, in a sense, the heart and soul of what you were doing for your Nana and a way to give it the right sort of context in terms of what you were entering in, what you were entering into, and its importance. Tell us more about why this particular lovely prayer was so significant for you and your husband in this experience with your Nana.
It's an important the prayer continues it to all such good things as thou hast prepared for us to walk in, and may delight in your will and walk in thy ways. Delight in thy will and walk in thy ways. And the whole idea is that Renaissance language that Thomas Cranmer used, not just to say we're going to do your will, okay, you've put this here, we're going to do it, damn it. It's not that. It's, can I delight in your will? How do I find the delight in it. How? She's dying. She's angry. I can't figure out how to get more time. She's bringing into our household her anger. We have all of these new nurses trying out. My daughter comes home. She's waiting for me. She tells me Nana was mean again to the ladies. We don't quite know how to keep her well taken care of. I don't know. You know, my dad comes in on Sunday afternoons after church and sits with her. And then she says to me, I don't feel safe with him. Don't leave me alone. This is my dad. This is your son. How can I find a way? Dig deeper into your faith. Where is the delight? You've got life. You've got breath. Figure out delight. And that's what would say to me if it's one of those crazy thaw days in January. Pop her in the wheelchair. Go outside. Drive to the place where, you know, she has a memory. And sit there in the car, you know, with a cup of coffee done just like she likes. And talk about it. You know, to figure out something. So that I do not give in to my own feeling of panic or being trapped or being angry or feeling controlled. Don't stop it. Figure out something. Do another meditation. Well, I mean, we were moderately successful, sometimes brilliantly successful, and sometimes a failure at that, which is why St. Paul says you should pray without ceasing, because we keep failing at it.
Well, there was, of course, plenty of success in this wonderful story, and along the way you learned all kinds of wonderful lessons, including some from some of the people who came in to assist, like Nurse Barbara, who you say voiced simple compassion, clear-eyed practice, never complicated by pity. And many other experiences as you wrestled with having influence but no control over the ultimate circumstances. And ultimately, this is a story that is so inspiring and reassuring on all kinds of different levels, and disarmingly honest as well, which is a real hallmark of what makes this book so special. Again, it is titled Lady Sitting, My Year with Nana at the End of Her Century. Published by W.W. Norton & Company and the author, Lorene Carey. Lorene Carey, thank you for writing such a lovely book, and thank you for being part of the morning show and talking about it today. I've really enjoyed this and very much enjoyed your book. Best wishes.
Thank you so very much. Appreciate it.
Tomorrow on The Morning Show, an interview with author Brad Baluchkin, author of a wonderful book called The Wax Pack. Brad Baluchkin, as a youngster, collected Topps baseball cards. Remember those baseball cards? And there would always be one stick of bubblegum in there as well. As a young adult, thinking back to that, he went on eBay and purchased a packet of Topps baseball cards from 1986, so from decades earlier, and then he sought out a very interesting project to try to reach out to all of the baseball players pictured on those particular baseball cards, traveling all over the country. And his book about that fascinating odyssey is this new book called The Wax Pack. You'll hear my interview with him tomorrow. Support for The Morning Show comes from Carthage College, where students can conduct NASA research, produce an original play, or join an in-house marketing agency as early as their freshman year. More information is available at carthage.edu.